Hi, this is Richard Campbell from .NET Rocks. I'm here with an esteemed panel.
What?
Esteemed panel of software quality enthusiasts. How's that?
Here, here.
I'm going to start at the far end. Do some introductions. Mr. Hollis? Reverend Hollis?
Yes, Richard. You want me to introduce myself?
Absolutely. Introduce yourself.
Oh, now, see, I just hate to do that. Author, speaker at conferences, but I spend probably two-thirds of my time working on software projects, leading teams. A lot of healthcare software, and typically software that demands a higher level of user experience than typical systems.
And I was looking at some of the new stuff you've built just recently. You're shipping software these days like crazy.
I've got some interesting stuff based in WPF that we'll be transitioning to Silverlight.
Fantastic.
Software as a service. So we see a lot of things coming together to allow some new opportunities.
Cool. Dr. Neil.
Dr. Neil Rudin, software developer, regional director for Australia, MVP for Windows Live Platform, involved in quite a large breadth of software development projects and I guess pushing agile and extreme programming since the end of the 90s. Before it was cool, long before it was cool, when people were like, you're mad.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
And I know you say you're from Australia, but near as I can tell, all you do is store your clothes there. You're not actually there very often.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, I actually spend most of my time on an airplane.
Yeah. But I know you're working on projects in the UK.
UK, as well as actually in the around US. Europe, do some stuff in the US and some stuff in Asia too, and then occasionally I go home. Yeah.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. Jeffrey Palermo. Because I did party with Palermo this week.
You did?
Yes.
Great party. Tech Ed speaker this time around, two sessions in the architecture track. I'm currently writing a book called ASP.NET MVC in Action with Manning. Microsoft Most Valuable Professional. Austin.NET User Group Leader, Inetis Speaker, and CTO of Headspring Systems, Austin's leading agile consulting company. And
mobile billboard.
Yes, you are well labeled there, Mr. Palermo.
Absolutely.
And I can feed you for the advertising space.
All right, next up.
Great. My name is Nilesh. Nilesh Kambolkar, Senior Product Manager with Microsoft. About a six-month veteran Microsoft.
You drew the short straw. Do you know what this panel's about?
Absolutely.
Yes, you were the designated punching bag.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And the punching bag spent about 12 years in the industry, half of which writing code, being a developer, and then the other half building products to test applications and promoting all those.
And you and what group
software
are you
quality.
With? You're with
the I'm with the VSTS team system.
Okay.
Team,
so the test edition
on the test edition, right?
Fantastic.
Exactly.
One of my favorite products,
exactly.
Truly.
Yep. Great. Love it.
And in competition for the curmudgeon of the panel, David Platt.
Yes, my name is David Platt. I am the head honcho of Rolling Thunder Computing. I'm the only honcho of Rolling Thunder Computing. I write some books. I teach some classes at Harvard University Extension School, among others. And my role on this panel is the designated gadfly and loose cannon. And if anybody thinks that I am unqualified for this role, let me tell you that I just finished a book entitled Why Software Sucks.
I got it right here.
Thank you, on behalf of my creditors. And that's the thing that I'm doing here today.
And the discussion here is software quality, and it actually took a while to really pick out all of the panelists. I started talking to Neil about this first, and the fun part is I've got a group of guys here who actually ship software regularly. So if software sucks, it's obviously your fault.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. and you know, us as a representative of the software development industry, it is our fault. The software industry sucks. As a whole, David's book says it all, right? And there's a lot of issues with what we do on a regular basis in the software industry. And, you know, it rolls on lots of different levels, from how we actually write the code in the first place, through to how we test it, through to how we validate it, through to how we, you know, even before that, how we gather requirements and talk to customers and understand what customers want, understand what experiences, which is where Billy spends a lot of time, what experiences the customers not just expect, not just are demanding, but actually would help them get their jobs done better. And you know, the reality is often, and I'm sure you're aware of this, customers don't know what's possible. And so, you know, it's our job to really enlighten them as to what they could do with software, you know, beyond the their expectation of, well, I want a message box.
It's not their job to know what's possible.
Right. Yeah,
that's
I'd be very disturbed if a customer asked me for a message box. That's almost like the new too much.
Right.
Don't we want them to just describe their work to us, and we try and find ways to make that more efficient?
That's exactly it. I hear people say, know thy user, he is not thee. You know, you need to build what your user needs to have, and the programs come to you and say, well, I can't because the user doesn't know what he wants. And, well, you know, fine, it's not his job to know what he needs. Just like when you go to your doctor, do you say, yes, my second metatarsal here is rubbing against the medial ligament and needs some non-steroidal anti-inflammatories? No. You say, ow, my foot hurts. And it is the doctor's job to ask questions about, well, you know, is it the left foot or the right foot? You know, is it the morning or the afternoon? You know, you have a nail sticking out. I see. And it is our job to ask the questions of the users and to do the due diligence and perform whatever testing needs to happen so that we can find the answers to the questions. That is our job.
I would maintain that at least 98% of the time that you hear a software developer say the user doesn't know what he wants, what that really means is that the person that's responsible on the technical end doesn't know how to ask the right questions.
Right.
Because I've never experienced that personally. If I keep asking the right questions, eventually I will find out what the user wants. Now, you may have to, that may take longer than you'd like. I make jokes, and you guys may have seen my video about how too many people in this industry are addicted to writing code. That's what they want to do. Talking to the user is not what they want to do.
Right.
But that's our responsibility, and if we don't manage to find out what the user wants, it is not the user's fault, except in a very minuscule sliver of cases.
Absolutely. Yeah. An anecdote, if I may, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think to add to that, you know, 74% of the time, it's the end user that first discovers an application issue in production, right? And the challenge is, if we were talking to them in the first place and understanding exactly what they wanted, you wouldn't have a lot of those issues kind of cropping up in the production in the first place, right? It's almost embarrassing to find an application issue in production when you could have caught it like way ahead, even at the time when you're architecting.
It's about feedback loops. And so, you know, from an agile perspective, I say ship early, ship often. I want to get my proof of concepts, my early version ones, iteration 1, 2, 3, out to the customers or a subset of customers that they can play with it and start getting feedback back into the development team as to what works for them, what doesn't work for them, how they're playing with stuff, how they're using the technology.
And every application has a feedback loop, or right. every development process ultimately has a feedback loop, because it's just a question of when the user sees
timing.
The app.
That's right.
So the what we would call waterfall method just stretches out over 18 months and a lot of commitment before it shows up. And the agile method, you're trying to just make that very short. But that doesn't sound like we're educating the user any better or collecting requirements any better. We're just doing it faster.
Well, we're getting opportunity to amend faster. And so the opportunity to make the amends to our product, to get to in the 18 months, to get to a position where the shipping product is actually something that's very usable, very high quality, and what the user wants, is much higher chance of getting there than if we just kind of hide in a room coding for 12 months.
I find it interesting that every project ends up being iterative. Now, agile projects start out iterative, but every project, even if it's waterfall, eventually ends up iterative at the point that it's late.
Yes.
Of course, because every time, and bar none, when you first present a program to a user, invariably he says, yeah, that's just what I asked for, but not what I want. and the trick is to make that happen sooner so that you can find out what he does want, because he can't formulate what he wants. But when he sees it and has a straw man to poke it, he can say, I like this over here, but that thing over there is not doing it for me. And the sooner you find it out, the sooner you can fix it.
But now, is this got a lot? I'm just debating how much this has to actually do with quality of software. We were talking about the requirements gathering, but we're presuming all along here that the code we write works.
Yeah, that's a big presumption to make.
It is a pretty big presumption.
Yeah.
But it depends on the engineering process. I don't like calling coding software development, because that's too wishy-washy. Some people want to say, oh, but coding is an art. And in that case, you can't evaluate it, because its value is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
But we need it to be an engineering practice where there are concrete methods of evaluating, and that is the satisfaction of the customer, no surprises from the customer's perspective. So we need a engineering process that drives down defects to zero, and we need that to be repeatable.
I'm not sure that that's a reasonable goal, because
it's not a reasonable
it's not even achievable. A reasonable philosophy from this following standpoint. The cost of an error, there's a certain cost that a bug has in terms of the economic impact or in some metric that you take. If that's very low, but the cost of fixing it or preventing it is very high, then it doesn't make economic sense to do that. Let's talk about an extreme example of what I saw from an actual person who's very active and agile and was presenting at a major conference and told the audience that pair programming is good, you should have two developers, you should write three lines of test code for every line of production code, you should have a ratio of two testers for every developer. That was his ideal. Now, I'm sorry, not every project needs that level of commitment of resources. If it's a human resources thing and it fails today and that means that a guy doesn't get hired until tomorrow, that is not the impact that requires us to double or triple or quadruple the amount of resources that are taken to make that product work. So we have to balance quality with the amount of money too. Saying that we're just gonna drive for zero bugs under all circumstances, I think is a completely unrealistic way to do it, because we've only got finite resources. That's just the way the world works. We have to allocate those resources.
Let me clarify what I'm saying, because you made an argument against something that I didn't put out. So I said defects, and you're talking about bugs, and there's a difference. Anything that bugs a user is a bug. But defects is more of an engineering term, where you have a product manager or someone who's in charge of saying, this is what I expect the software to do. And any gap in the actual behavior and the expected behavior, we can say that's a defect, that's concrete. Now, a bug, yeah, that's more fuzzy. But the product manager can say, this is undesirable behavior, but because of ROI concerns, I'm going to be okay with it. And so therefore, it becomes expected behavior. And from the engineering department, they know that that's what's expected. You still have zero defects because the actual behavior is exactly in line with expectations.
So we'll redefine bugs away if we don't like them.
We have to differentiate what we're talking
about. As long as they didn't report the bugs, we'd have no defects.
Or if we just learned to love our bugs.
It's not a
bug. Doctors bury their mistakes.
We've got terminology issues.
What do programmers do with our bugs? We say it's a feature, don't we?
We got terminology issue here.
Forgetting about the terminology issue, The cost of fixing bugs, I want to know, why is it so high? Why, you know, it's just software. For Christ's sake, it's just software. Why are we building software where making a change, the cost is so high?
Well, that's the first thing. How easy is it to repair your cell phone? It's extremely costly. You more or less can't do it. It is far more cost effective to throw away your cell phone and buy a new one rather than a hardware issue, not a software issue. Software is the same thing.
Right? No, software is not the same thing. Moving a line of code around, changing methods, fixing bugs is very cheap if you build your software right.
Nonsense.
I've heard programmers
say this every time. And programmers think that, oh yes, it just takes me 5 minutes to move the line from here to there. And they say it's only a 5-minute fix. And to them it is. But there are these enormous, and I mean enormous, downstream costs that concur to software. Typically, when I talk to program managers, they say, "Okay, what is the total cost of moving a line? Figure out the cost of the programmer's time to do the thing, and multiply it by 50 to 100 plus or minus. You have to document it. You have to write the tests for it. You have to tell the QA guys about it. The QA guys have got to do it. Whatever change you've made, if it has to do with the user interface, now you've got to change all the user interface documentation that tells the user what to do with it. You have to change the training" to tell the user what they're doing. You have to train the QA guys to ask the phone support guys to ask the questions when something isn't working. Might it have been this line of code? There are these absolutely huge downstream costs. And so while it looks trivial to the programmer who's doing it, that means they're failing to recognize these huge downstream costs. And
aren't we talking about preventing defects as a measure of as a means to raise quality? That's talking about fixing the defect and the cost
that's
of that.
That's after it's gone to production.
Why don't we write it in such a way so that we prevent the defects? There's lots of research that says, defects are really expensive when you find them downstream. So why aren't we building our systems?
You're absolutely right that we need to do this. And in software engineering, just now we are at the transition. Back in colonial times or so, every gun, every rifle was made, was handcrafted by a craftsman using tools that he had built himself and was not interchangeable with anything else. And you could recognize a particular craftsman by, if you looked at a gun and you knew about craftsman, you could tell who built it. And software engineering needs to make this transition from an individual craftsman, artisan kind of thing to an engineering kind of thing. Medicine is just now starting to make that transition from an individual doctor is an art kind of thing to this evidence-based medicine sort of thing, where they very carefully do large studies and find out what works and what doesn't, and then force, you know, doctors to do that kind of thing.
Chunk of the code that we've now have in our app, and I'm thinking stuff like the framework, exactly that way. It's mass-produced code that we use over and over again. There's a layer on top of it that's still crafted.
It's just a library. When you say, hey, there's a new application, what do you normally say, hey, use approach XYZ? No, you say, go do it. And then the team lead, the architect, is sitting down thinking, how do I want to best approach this? And they're just doing it from scratch. They're not saying, oh, I'm following this type of methodology in my architectural approach. They're formulating their process as they try to formulate an application.
Reinventing the wheel each time is what you're saying.
So I want to talk a little bit about, to your point about defects, is the fundamental kind of mindset of a developer versus a tester, right? One is constructing things, one is building things, versus from a testing quality perspective, you're looking at how do you break. So to your point about defects, right, am I building my software in the same environment it's supposed to run in? Right. It's from an environment perspective, as I look at
it. It's not necessarily are you building, but are you testing it?
It's how you're testing it. Are you testing it in the way the end users are using it? Are you testing it in the way that the application eventually gets deployed?
How long is it between when you write it and when you test it? Is it seconds or is it hours?
I think part of it is testing earlier, testing more often earlier, trying to find a lot of the issues that you're running into otherwise at a later time.
And this is support for Billy's statement of 3 lines of test code for every real line of code, 2 testers for every developer.
Well, he was actually arguing against what he heard someone else say.
Well,
yeah.
And I don't think I agree with that.
But that's when people start talking about trying to keep down the number of defects, or however what terminology you like to use, that seems to be the methods I hear that they want to do.
But I think the presumption here is that is less expensive than correcting the defects.
That is, and I'm not convinced of that.
My old boss used to say, perfection is the surest route to bankruptcy. You could make a car that would never, ever, 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 ever break, but nobody could afford to buy one, and then your company would quickly out of business. Billy is entirely right saying, well, we need to find out just what is the performance metric for the kinds of things that we're doing. If we're building software for life support or air traffic control, well, that is one level of quality. If we're building solitaire, that is a different level of quality. And if you put the first one in the second, that is highly inappropriate use of resources, and you'll never make any money.
Let's look at the economics. We have a certain amount to spend on software. Suppose we could spend it making the user 5% more productive, or we could spend it eliminating certain kinds of defects that would cause an hour of downtime a month. Okay? Economically speaking, the 5% more productive wins. Although, that's a day per month that you've added.
Certainly,
okay?
There and are defects that would cost us 5% a month as well.
That's right. There are. But we can't obviously necessarily measure these, because there are too many unknowns.
Right.
But if we could, and the defect only cost us an hour a month, and the productivity
gained us a day a month,
then that's a better investment, even though we're going to leave the defect there.
But the real question is, why is that defect there in the first place?
I understand that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that we have finite resources.
For finding and fixing, you're saying?
Right.
For everything. For the entire process. A business doesn't say, I'm going to spend this much on quality control in making this software work, and I'm going to spend this much on user experience. They say, this is how much I'm going to spend to get this software system. Now you guys figure out how to spend that money.
So Billy, you're saying it's okay for a certain number of bucks to just show up in production and deal with it.
It depends on the system, but sometimes, yes.
But what if the impact, right? You're talking about the business. What if the impact impact of the business is, you know, every minute you're down, it's $10 million.
Then
how do you know that when you're writing the code?
Then in that,
you don't know that from the problem domain.
The problem domain tells you that.
You have committed malpractice.
That's right.
Okay? That is a requirement that you need to know. So, and if you do not know that before you touch a keyboard, you have committed malpractice.
So no, this is your point of, you know, whether you're building solitaire, you're building a mission critical application, right? If you're building a mission critical application, it's important to kind of get that team to collaborate.
It's not important. It's life or death.
It's critical, right? It's critical. That's why it's mission critical, right?
Are you saying when you write the software, you intentionally leave a defect because of an ROI or balance?
On occasion, yes, we have. We have left defects in the software, covered them up, whatever it took.
No, but you wrote the defect.
This. We all write defects.
Did you intentionally write it, or did you discover it?
No, it was discovered at some point, and it was decided that it does not make economic sense to fix this thing.
That makes sense, but why doesn't the process cause the defects to not get created?
Because there is no magical process that does that. And I don't care what the test-driven people tell me. There is no such process.
Jeff, do you have any children?
I do.
Okay, can I ask how old?
9 months.
9 months, okay. Well, when their teeth come in, at a certain point, you're going to take your 3-year-old or your 4-year-old to the dentist, and the dentist is going to say, oh, you've got a cavity in this tooth here. And I can fill it for $50 and stick a needle in and drill, or we can wait 2 years and it'll fall out on its own, and nothing bad will happen in between now and then. And what are you going to tell the dentist to do? No, that's a defect, fix it now!
No, I'm not arguing for that.
But you don't keep making these analogies between things that are not software and software. You know, it's
everything in the world is analogies.
Yeah, but software is different from hardware or a kid's tooth. You can't.
Not that different. There is very little that's new under the sun.
Nah,
so I guess what Billy's saying is...
Remember COM and INPROC and out-of-proc servers, right?
Oh, yeah, very
much. The INPROC server was having unprotected sex. Out-of-proc through a proxy and stub was wearing a condom. All right.
Maybe we should talk about functional defect. Okay, if it's a performance thing or something happens once every blue moon. But a functional thing.
It depends upon the nature of that function and how valuable that function is.
I think to Billy's point, you're weighing the cost of the bug.
I am.
Against the cost of the feature.
Life is trade-offs.
But the point is, why are we writing them in the first place? There are ways to prevent it from happening. If you have a functional issue, if you did do that with TDD, you would not get that occurring in the first place.
Neil, I have a tough time believing
my tests?
That there's a
how
procedure
How do I know that my
flawless.
Tests are perfect?
Okay, so we are human beings.
I don't.
We are imperfect.
You argued against TDD before anyone on the panel ever mentioned it.
I mentioned it as one of the things people claim is a way to do it, and he just brought it up as one of the ways to do it.
I happen to coach teams that do it. However, I don't think that's what increases quality. I think the way you design your system is what increases quality. And functional programming talks about side effect free software. That increases it. If we can do that in our imperative languages, and that's some of the techniques that my company employs, if you can eliminate globals, eliminate the side effects that happen so that it's repeatable, you increase the design, increase the quality of the design.
You do.
Which
you
reduces
can,
the
you
defects
can increase it,
down
but
to a minuscule number, very, very close to zero.
Minuscule isn't zero, though.
And
I'm still going to find things.
Zero is your goal.
Guys, more to the point, I mean, what is the zeroth law of computer science? Garbage in, garbage out, is it not?
Yep.
Unless you have the requirements correct, and the problem definition correct, and the design correct, it doesn't matter how good you are or aren't at implementing it, because you will have a very expensive paperweight when you get it done.
Absolutely.
Right?
So even if you have that correct, right, what if you don't share it?
I have a great requirements document, right?
But it doesn't translate. That's my point, right? I think the point is, even if you have requirements, it has to kind of filter through across the team members, across quality and across development, across product.
Of course.
Right, but part of what happens is requirements change midstream during your project. What are you going to do about that? How do you manage that? And it's a changing world, right?
I don't believe that.
Put it in the agile cycle and propagate the requirements
feedback
across the team as fast as
early
you can.
Often.
But if your design has a concrete foundation, it's going to be hard to change. So you need your design to be very flexible and not have this concrete layer on the bottom says, okay, this is our foundation. But I see a lot of teams writing code where They bake in the assumptions, and then if the assumptions change, it's very hard to change the behavior of the software.
But is there a cost to that flexibility as well?
There's always a cost to flexibility.
Yeah. Sure, there's a cost. How high is it? Well, I have found it to be lower than the cost of finding and fixing.
Would we all agree here that money is a universal common denominator?
Yep.
That's what you're saying.
That's
about the
basically what I'm saying. It sounds like I'm arguing for systems that don't work in some sense in the field. When one of the major systems I've done, 2,000 operators in call centers use it 8 hours a day. I wrote some of the key pieces six, seven years ago. They've never failed. They're black box things. They're obviously pretty high quality things. So I'm not arguing for that at all. But I'm saying there's a huge broad range of software, and trying to say dogmatic principles about this is the way that we have to do it because in our experience and the kinds of systems we do, that's what's necessary. Does not translate to nearly the kind of range that we would like in the bigger, broader world. Something that works at some decent functional level beats having nothing at all. So if it takes me a year and twice as much or three times as much money to get there, and that means people can't afford it to get to the level of quality you're talking about, then no, they'll take something that's lower quality but that you can put in their hands for a price they can afford. That's all I'm saying is that things vary a whole lot, and we just cannot take the kind of dogmatic view that quality is going to be the thing that we strive for under all circumstances. Yes, we don't want our software to be buggy, but we have to trade that off against all the things that the user needs, and the functionality is one of them.
And that is what engineering is, okay? When I was in engineering school, did you go to engineering school, Jeff? Because I did. I hold a Master of Engineering degree in case anybody gives a damn. Not that it matters. But the very first design class I ever took, the guy read us a poem, which I will not recite, about a one-horse shay. It's a carriage, and always there's the weakest spot. It breaks here, it breaks there, it breaks there, it breaks here. And there's a deacon who says, mine isn't going to, and he makes every part as strong as every other part. And 100 years later, it flies to pieces all at once, and nothing first, which is kind of nice. But in real life engineering, you have to make trade-offs, you have to make the design decisions, you have to make compromises. When you look at a car in a junkyard, every single car in a junkyard is there for one reason. I mean, something broke that was not cost-effective to fix. And all the rest of the things on the car still work. That's why it's in a junkyard, so somebody can take it for parts. Now, it broke for one reason, and you know they break for different reasons, some more and some less. But you know, that part broke, and now the other parts there were made too strong. They were made stronger than they had to be. They were made better than they had to be. Money was wasted on those. Money, time, effort, lives were wasted on those pieces that could have been spent on something else that you actually did care about. Now, you know, it's hard to pick this out in other than a statistical sense, but to say zero defects is to my way of thinking, failing to think it through.
You're putting it in a straw man sense, because that is the goal, but there's always trade-offs. If there needs to be a trade-off, then there is one, but that is the goal. And if you don't have that goal, you're bound to have...
So I guess maybe the way of thinking about this is not necessarily getting to zero defects from the ground up, but if your goal is to get to zero defects, you would look for solutions and processes, the way you write code, the way you think about deployment ahead of time and build it into your architecture, and all of those things is kind of where optimizations could help quality get earlier in the life cycle, right?
My goal is to get software the users find valuable.
That's my goal too.
Right. Okay, right. That is my goal. And everything else is subservient to that. Every other goal
is
subservient
to that. Is that goal accomplished when the quality
cases,
is poor?
It depends. It depends.
I get what I want.
Sometimes when the quality is good enough.
Good enough. The quality is good enough.
There is no meaning to poor. It does what the user needs it to do, or it does not do what the user does. It makes the user happy, or it does not.
Right. I mean, there's a functional software, but there's a poor performing software. If I'm taking 10 minutes to go do something I need to do.
Is this purely about taking the list of what the user's got and pushing that down?
You're saying good enough. If it does exactly what the user wants it to do, then it is high quality.
And takes an hour to do it?
How are we to say that it's medium quality if the user loves it?
Yes. If the user is sleeping while it happens, yes. If the user is sitting there saying, hurry up, then no.
I mean,
so if it does exactly what the user wants it to, it's high quality.
That's right.
It means
even if it's got defects in it.
Well, but if the user sees exactly what they want, then there's not defects.
Oh, there could be all kinds of defects the user doesn't see. There could be stuff going on in the background, kludges that somebody has to sort out, somebody on the team has to come back and rearrange things, and our deployment is messed up. But if the user never sees it, then the user's
there's more of a question that the user simply tolerant of it.
I remember apps
where the user was perfectly used to rebooting the machine every hour.
Right.
And they considered themselves productive. They were making their way through that app. It may not have been as productive as it should have been. One would debate what the quality was, just because it's acceptable, you know, that they're tolerant of that.
I think it's back to, you know, it's this goal, it's this concept of aiming for zero defects.
Well, in the sense, I
want to go back to what the gentleman in the audience said, and that is that, you know, we are talking about software, we work on software, we ship software, we're talking about building software. At the end of the day, the user is not coming to us to buy software. Did you come to my talk on why software sucks? Yeah. The user is not buying software from us. What is the user buying?
They're solving their pain.
They're buying relief of pain. And if we relieve their pain, we've done a good job. If we don't, we haven't.
I mean, I'm not sure when you talk about having the goal. Does anybody have a goal of going to... Does anybody sit down and go, I'm going to write a bug now?
No, exactly.
Okay? Well, nobody does that. So in that sense, everybody has the goal of not writing bugs, defects. So, I mean, that's a tautological thing, is that nobody sits down and says, I'm going to write a defect right now. Therefore, we all have that goal.
But I guess, Billy, so some of the issues that I see in applications, right, you have a recursive method and there's a database connection call being opened inside of it. So when you look at it, a lot of coding, the way we code is cut and paste and look at, this thing does what I want it to do. Can I move this around here and get it to work? So I think also when you don't understand the broader implications of kind of what that piece of code does and you're using that, it becomes a challenge. Not now, right? In my development environment, my desktop, this works. But what if I throw that into a composite environment where I'm now interacting with, you know, third-party services and running on environments that I never dreamed it was supposed to run on, right? So I think there is a kind of a balance in my mind where I think, yeah, when you tend to do zero defects, you're going to look for process improvements. You're going to look for ways to engineer your solution, to architect your solution that will minimize it, right?
But
at the end of the day, because of this different way we're building the software, you may be right in that there might be issues that do crop up in production. That you, nobody can foresee. If
right.
I had
so
a list of things that I would see
that,
right?
That's what you're about, right? Is how do you validate that's where we're at?
Right.
That's where we're moving towards.
I made a change in my code. What's impacting it? To your earlier point, right? What do I need to test? What does quality mean? You know, somebody's gone and made a change. What do I need to test? How does that impact my iteration? How does that impact my release cycle?
Right.
And how do I manage that change
but
to go?
Let me tell you a real story with me as the user end to talk about some of the limitations here, okay? So, I went to shop for a new computer last year to replace my 5-year-old desktop. And ended up buying a Lenovo. And I went to their site to shop for it. Now, I'm a geek, right? So I want to see what the back of the computer looks like. And they have this thing that rotates the computer. So you can look at it from any angle. And I start the dragging operation. And it moves a tenth of a degree and takes about 5 seconds to paint. And then another tenth of a degree. And it took over 10 minutes to turn that thing around to see the back. Okay? Now, I'm sure that the guy that developed that thing tested it thoroughly. Because if you ran it on a machine with fast video, it would do fine.
Right.
But I'm shopping for a computer. If I'm shopping for a computer today, what kind of computer have I got right now?
Yep.
Okay? So, did he think about that in his quality process?
He didn't know
the thing
his
didn't
user.
Crash.
No, that user
that's right.
is not deep.
So the coding wasn't the problem. It was before that in the analysis.
We're all the way back then.
But first, last, and only law of UX design, know that user, he is not D. That guy did not follow it.
Yeah.
There's two portions here. One is, okay, once you know exactly what you're doing, yeah, we can talk about coding, we can talk about testing, we can talk about tools, yeah. But before that, know thy user and pulling out not just the surface pain of what they say they think they need, but drive down to what they really want, what they're really going to be satisfied with. That's a lot harder, in my opinion, than the coding aspect.
I completely agree,
absolutely.
And that's where we should spend more of our time and effort.
So are we walking our way to the bugs are actually the user's fault? Because they don't know what they want?
No, it's our fault.
It is our fault for not figuring out what the users want.
If we can't discover what the user wants, then what are we doing in this profession?
Look, here's an anecdote.
Right, so how do we get there?
Here's the perfect analogy. My father, he first graduated from medical school, right? And he's a brand new intern. The ink isn't even dry on his MD. Guy comes in complaining he hadn't had a bowel movement in a week, right? So my father said, okay, that's easy. Here, try this laxative. Doesn't work. Tries a strong one. Doesn't work. Tries an enema. Nothing comes out. Tries a fluoroscope. Doesn't see anything. Takes him up to the operating room. Even opens up his belly. Does an exploratory laparotomy to see what the hell's wrong with the guy. This is unremarkable. It's a normal abdomen. Finally, he does what he should have done in the first place, which is take a thorough history, in the course of which he asks the patient what he does for a living. Guy says, I'm a musician. Finally, the light goes on. Ah, no wonder. Look, here's $10. Go get something to eat.
That's right.
Very nice.
I'll be
very
here
nice.
All week. Try the veal. Anyway, but the point is, you know, what the user says to you often is not the real problem, because mm-hmm. the guy doesn't really know. And it's our job to do what we need to do, whatever that is, to find out what the real problem really, really is. That's our job.
So if we gather really great requirements, we won't have any more bugs.
Let me lay on requirements.
Well, it helps.
Garbage in, garbage out. If we fail to do an excellent job on requirement gathering, the software cannot possibly, no matter how high quality you do, no matter how many zero defects you get, no matter how many you did, no matter how agile you are, if we don't get the requirements document right in the very first place, the
disagree.
The
you will never get it right in the very first place.
No,
you will never
you'll
get
never
it
get right.
Right.
You'll,
I, no, I know what you said. Okay, yes. Yeah.
And if we try to get the whole thing before you start, then...
You're right. Okay, if we don't get the documents right, you know, quickly, iteratively, well, you know, by release anyway.
What you have to do is have a feedback loop built into your cycle so that you can constantly be validating that what you're talking to the user about is what they're expecting.
I accept that correction.
We aim in our process at getting... in the 90s on percent of understanding of requirements before we begin. Now, some people don't even want to go that high. Well, and then the rest of it has to be discovered in an iterative fashion.
Okay.
I would grant that. But you do have to, but if you drop, in my respect, in my understanding and the way that coming out of my own experience, if you drop too far below that 90, now your iterative process is very inefficient. Yeah, you may eventually get to where you want to go, but you end up throwing away so much of the stuff that you worked on that if you had gotten closer on the requirements in the beginning, so there's kind of a nice balance point in there where you get the optimal process of how much requirements you find up front versus how much you find during iteration. And I guess that probably varies from project to project. But for us, we're looking at somewhere in the 90% range at the beginning.
So out of that 90, how much of the entire scope of the project do you need to get? Do you need to get 90% of the entire scope? Or do you need to get 90% of the first component you're building?
90% of the minimal function set that a user needs
for the entire
scope of the, but there may be a lot of things they bring up that we intentionally say that is future and we will put that on a list for later.
You won't count that,
and now we won't count that in our 90.
Okay.
So let me rail on requirements documents, because there's a lot of people who spend a lot of time working on requirements. I met a lot of people who are visual. I've met some people who are audio. But I've never met someone who was textual that said, oh, I communicate best by reading text on a page.
I do that a lot, as a matter of fact, for me.
You just met him.
There he is.
His name's David.
How are you? So, given that most of the population is visual, I found, and this is what I coach teams to do, is if they're documenting requirements, that everyone does it to some extent, depending on the organization, make it pictures. We've all heard a picture is worth 1,000 words. So replace 1,000 words with a picture and draw on it.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Can you express that statement to me pictorially? I don't think so.
Touché.
So, I mean, we've got a guy who's serious about Studio Test Edition, but isn't that problem solved by Studio Architect Edition?
It's solved by people.
Yeah,
not totally.
How much does Microsoft pay you to say that?
But the issue I have with the diagram, right, I don't disagree, but I don't have a good cocktail napkin binder, right? I mean, the problem is I draw those pictures and they die. They're there, but now they're a maintenance headache as I'm trying to develop this app.
Do they die or do they stay in your head and the development team's head?
I think you draw them, you show them, we love them, we go off and work on them. Then reality hits as we build software, and the diagram no longer reflects what we built.
Okay, so what happened between that time and the 5 or 10 days when you have the screen ready to show the user for the first time saying, is this right? We talked about it, now is this right?
I think that's what happens when you build software, is that you get into what did I have to do to actually make go from that diagram to that code.
I mean, if you wait a long time, sure. But if you're just if you're talking with the user, visually looking through it, and maybe it takes you maybe it takes you 3 weeks before you can actually deliver it, and you're talking and showing them the revs, how could I go wrong?
And yet we do.
But is it that the diagram has now changed? Yeah. Is that the issue? That now if you were to draw what you've built, the diagram isn't the same as the diagram that you started with?
I think that's
with?
The issue. But you know what we didn't define up front here is what do you see as a diagram? I'm sorry, I immediately thought UML, but I may be the only guy who did.
Ah, you're thinking tools. I'm thinking like the simplest frame. Thing that can communicate the idea. A pencil with a snapshot of an image. Put in your
a lot more than I disagree with them. I really.
But an image of what?
An image of what you drew on the whiteboard.
A screenshot.
Okay. So what did I draw on the whiteboard?
Or you can also take. Yeah, I love taking screenshots of existing screens that they want enhanced, and use the simple PowerPoint tools to draw a call out and say, "I want this different."
Yeah, great. Jeff, what did you draw on the whiteboard?
On the whiteboard is screens that don't exist, and you're fleshing them out.
So you're drawing the user's screens of the app.
Right, and you say, okay, user, you're talking about, or the product manager, or there's a proxy, what's the flow? Let's talk about the persona of who's using the screen. What are they going to do? What are they trying to do? And what's the natural order of progression? And let's try to make a screen that's going to accomplish that.
So it's kind of paint programming.
Sure.
Paint requirements gathering.
I'm not sure that.
Hair analysis.
I'm not sure that works as well in a WPF Silverlight world as it does with current tools, at least given what the users understand about how UI should be constructed, because they have many, many preconceptions
that will complicate that
process.
We may have to start rethinking that.
Yeah, we may have to.
And there are a lot of different niches, but the line of business enterprise application that is non-flashy, that segment of the market is sufficiently huge to, you know,
we will get to the point where the new technologies need to apply to them, too. They need productivity,
sure,
too.
Absolutely.
Right. And I don't think people understand at this point how much UI is going to change in the next 5 to 10 years.
I surely don't.
So when you have that requirements, right, let me ask you, how do you what's the trade-off between how often you go back to the user and validate it versus kind of going through your, you know, a whole iteration versus,
We go back to the user every week. We have a standard time to do it.
So iterating short.
Our iterations are 5 business days.
Yeah, because you want to go back and feed that back into the whole process, right?
Not 6 months.
Well, so we're in violent agreement.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
1 week.
That's a shame.
1 week iteration.
1 thing. 1 week. 1 week.
Gentlemen, we're running out of time. Final thoughts. Mr. Hollis.
Oh, gosh. You know, you ask about this panel, software quality, and my first reaction was, well, I'm in favor of it.
Yes. I did entitle the panel, Software Quality Isn't Optional.
So I
think it would be a good idea.
So I think we are all in favor of it, but yeah, my key insight that I try to communicate is it's all a matter of trade-offs, and getting to what the user needs is first, and quality is defined within that context.
Okay. Dr. Neil.
Yeah, I'll disagree.
Excellent.
It's about quality. You've got to get your quality as high as you possibly can, always. The higher the quality of the software, the higher the quality of the software will remain through the development lifecycle. So right from iteration zero, keep that quality as high as you possibly can.
Jeff Palermo?
I agree mostly with Dr. Neil. The higher the quality, the better. And I would say the extra features, I would say that you can't have too high of quality. You would just say you have too much behavior for the situation. And I think that there's a difference between analysis and the construction of the software. I think the engineering component, the construction of the software, there's a lot to be desired in the way the general Microsoft developers work it. And in surveying my two architecture sessions, there's a lot of progress that needs to be made. But the analysis is the most important, because if you're building the wrong thing, then your code doesn't matter.
All right, Neil.
Great. Now, you know, I would actually have to say that while, you know, trade-off is a fact of life. Mm-hmm. You have to trade off everywhere you go. While that is true, I think we have to make every effort to get to a point where software works flawlessly, because software is everywhere. And as we build software, we have to strive towards building better software, bringing quality earlier into the development architecture side of the house, and really deploying applications that are higher quality.
It's a good thing you only said that at the end of the session, because we would have beaten you up for the rest of the session. Thank you. David.
Well, you guys have said all the geeky things that that need to or can be said, so I'll be a little philosophical.
No.
Yes.
Oh, that's a shame.
And say, what a fabulous time it is to be alive and in this industry. You know what I mean? Not for its birth that goes to giants like Turing and von Neumann, you know, nor for its childhood, other giants like Grace Hopper, but it's but its adolescence, stormy as always, into what I hope will become its adulthood. And goddamn, isn't it great?
Yeah. All right, guys, thanks very much.